So it was that, when the ailing King of Kings, in the late autumn of 486 BC, and before he could set out for Egypt, finally went away from the throne, as the Persians euphemistically put it, Xerxes succeeded to the monarchy of the world without opposition. Not that he lingered long to enjoy the acclaim. Taking up the reins of Darius' command, Xerxes was soon leaving his still festive capital for Egypt. Descending on the rebelling Egyptians, he briskly demonstrated that he was a chip off the old block. The revolt was summarily crushed, and Xerxes installed there as satrap one of his numerous brothers. Now at issue was a single question. What kind of task force should be marshalled for the invasion and conquest of Greece? Mardonius urged that only elite fighters, Persians themselves, Medes, Sarka, and East Iranians, be conscripted. Such a strike force would be able to move like lightning, outpace any foe, descend upon the lumbering infantrymen of the enemy with the same murderous speed that had always proved so lethal to the Greeks of Ionia. Yet this strategy had an insuperable drawback. Times had changed. How could an army drawn from so few satrapies possibly be considered sufficient for the dignity of the man who was to command it? What might have served Cyrus in the days of his mountain banditry was hardly adequate for his grandson, who ruled the world. Xerxes, when he conquered the West, would do so not merely as the king of Persia, but as king of all the dominions that lay beyond it, too. Indians in their cotton dhotis, with their tall bows made of cane. Ethiopians draped in leopard skins, armed with arrows tipped with stone. Moscians wearing wooden helmets. Thracians with fox skins wrapped around their heads, Scythians in turbans, Assyrians in linen corslets wielding their studded clubs, all would assemble before their master and march with him against the West. Admittedly, this swelling of his task force with a vast babel of poorly armed levies would generate any number of headaches for the great king's harassed commissariat. Transporting an army of the size envisaged by Xerxes across the Aegean was clearly out of the question. The only possible way to Athens was by land. This in turn would require wonders of preparation. The Hellespont would have to be bridged. Brushwood and tightly packed soil, spread out over an immense pontoon, were to unite Asia and Europe. Roads must be driven through the wilds of Thrace and Macedonia. Harvests planted, garnered, stored. And further west along the Aegean coast, where, 2 years before Marathon, Mardonius had lost his fleet, a great canal, hacked out from the isthmus below Mount Athos, was to free the Persian fleet from having to round the treacherous peninsula from which the mountain rose. And all of Greece would quake. To build a canal wide enough to permit two warships to pass, and 1.5 miles long, here was a commission beyond the scope of any mortal man, saving only one. As the labour gangs toiled, their hammer blows echoed far beyond Mount Athos, beating out a message of insistent and clamorous terror. All of Asia was stirring. The great king was drawing near.